Welcome back, continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are now chatting with Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review, and it's time to dive a bit more into individual companies and some individual stories from the resource sector and a recent trip that Brian was just on to Japan, a site visit to Irving Resources. So we're going to be recapping Irving Resources, also talking about Montage Gold, taking a stake in Sanu Gold, that is an exploration company, as well as FPX Nickel announcing a share buyback. So Brian, let's start off with your recent visit to Japan. Irving Resources traded on the CSE under the symbol IRV. It's focused in Japan. It has a portfolio of projects, and it has slowly been exploring these projects. There seems to be some positive recent news out with some joint ventures with major miners. However, look, the stock price continues to be under pressure, and as we're recording this, I believe it's trading at all-time lows. So, Brian, give us your narrative, your analysis on Irving Resources, please.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, so it was a great week in Japan, especially to see Irving, a company I've been invested in for the better part of 5 years now. And it's been a real roller coaster, as you alluded to, Corey. The share price is at all-time lows, and I think the market is really missing the value in the company and maybe even the potential upside in the projects that they have. I'll start with Omu. That's what most people, if they've heard about Irving, that's what they're probably familiar with in the north. It's on the island of Hokkaido. And basically the drilling that they did there never uncovered the higher grade gold and silver mineralization that they were looking for. And so they kind of put a cap on that after hitting around 20,000 meters and just recently announced a joint venture with JX Mining, which is Japan's largest mining company. And JX is interested in using the silica found in the sinter, I guess the sinter cap of the low sulfidation system, for their smelters. And this is important for their smelting process, and the flux acts as not only like it prevents heat loss, but helps in the whole smelting process. So to me, that looks like a pretty good slam dunk to be a mine in the next couple of years. They're going to be doing some other drilling, of course, do the studies they need to do to get up to the time where this is going to become a mine and go through that process. The upside potential in that is if they hit any higher grade mineralization, they really haven't done a lot of deep holes at the sinter. And if you look at the agreement, the stuff that JX is going to have ownership over is, I believe, only 50 or 60 meters deep. So anything deeper that they find is basically a new negotiation between the two companies and because it is Irving's. So I see there's definitely potential there, but that's its own thing. What I really think investors need to look at right now is Yamagano, which is in the South Island of Kyushu. It's about an hour's drive from the airport in Kagoshima. Really interesting place, total contrast to the north, hot and humid. Tons of red cedars and mountainous in terms of setting. The significance of Yamagano is that it's about 14 kilometers south of Hishikari. For those that don't know, Hishikari is the highest grade gold mine in the world currently. It's owned by Sumitomo, has a head grade around 30 grams per ton. And these guys, this is not a 24/7 operation. These guys essentially mine a few hundred thousand ounces of gold per year and then basically shut it down. And that's been going on for, I think, since the late 80s. And so Yamagano is to the south. It's the same rocks, a little bit different age of systems here from what the geologist told us on the site visit. But the footprint and, again, the geology are very similar. And Yamagano is interesting. It's basically split into two different sections. You have East Yamagano, where they're doing the drilling right now, and West Yamagano, which is where the historical workings are. And it's the portion of the project which was optioned from the Shimazu family in Japan, which has a long history of mining there, but also of being what, like, basically royalty amongst the Japanese. And if you do any research on it, you'll see quite quickly how respected the Shimazu family is. So they've chosen to look at the East Yamagano first. It's where the prospecting license is. And it's where, if you look at the geophysical anomaly, it looks like the down dip extension of the historical workings at surface. And it's just so eerily similar to what you see at Hishikari. And they're doing 700 to 1,000 meter holes right now. They just finished hole number two while we were there, or just before we were there, and are currently on hole number three, which is scheduled to be done by the end of the year, with hole four and five to be done in Q1. So hole number two results are upcoming anytime this month. And then, of course, you've got three more holes at the end of the year. And I would say, you know, just judging by the talk around it, these holes are designed to take a look at the structures. If they hit mineralization or like high grade mineralization, that would be fantastic. But these are as much about exploring what is there because it's fairly deep and it's the down dip extension. And this is how Newmont wants to conduct it. So I think there's a lot of catalysts ahead. And of course, the upside potential when you compare it to something like Hishikari, the potential is definitely there. And that's why you have the largest gold miner in the world going after it. They don't go after small targets. And so that's how I look at the company right now. And considering it's trading at its all-time lows, I think for anybody with some speculative money that wants to play exploration, but in a project generator type of model where the risk to the junior is that much less, I think Irving's got to be near the top of your list.
Well, Brian, just following up on that very last point you made, that Sumitomo is not in this to go after small. They go big. And same thing with Newmont as a JV partner. And so with both of them in there as key strategic stakeholders, I mean, they just put out some news on October 17th that I think Newmont has 60%, Irving has 27.5%, and then Sumitomo has 12.5%. But you also have people like our friend of the show, Giant Bhandari, that was down on the site visit at the same time and reported back on excitement around this. You have Quentin Henning, one of the most preeminent geologists, very excited about it. So you have majors excited. You have people that understand the resource space, yourself included, that are excited. Yet the stock price at an all-time low. What is the retail market missing here?
I think people, you know, past is, they think, is prologue. COVID really smashed the news flow for Irving, where, you know, things completely slowed down. The Canadian drill crew that was there, that was originally drilling Omu, was basically shut out of the country. And this was kind of the story across the world. But of course, Japan, I think there was almost an extra layer there, just as it is. The bureaucracy and the approvals that need to be run are much slower than, let's say, Canada or maybe the US in some circumstances. So with the results not necessarily being there for Omu, and then the fact that news flow slowed right down, I think people got bored and they left. And new people to the story, again, you know, I don't think have had a steady flow of news to get excited about. But I think that's going to change. Again, the potential I see in Yamagano, I think, is what's being missed. And maybe it does need a few news releases to get out there for people to catch their attention. But for those people that were looking at Irving before, I think it is boredom slash, you know, they're saying this is what's going to be projected forward. And I disagree. I think that things are just starting to ramp back up. These drill crews that were trained in COVID or just post-COVID to do the drilling, Japanese run and led and operated, are starting to hit their stride. And so I think, you know, we're well on the way towards steadier news flow and getting the story back out to the market. So in essence, this is almost like a reboot for Irving coming up and hopefully on the back of some good results.
Well, let's face it, Brian, like this company needs some good drill results. And I think they also need to raise some money too. Their last financing, they raised just over $1 million back in June. If they want to really move this joint venture forward, fund the exploration that's needed to hopefully generate some of those drill results, well, they need funding and they need good drill results. There's no denying that, is there?
No, not at all. Not at all. And really, I guess those drill results are what pushes everything. You can be, I think, a little bit lackadaisical on the marketing side if your results are good. And that's the baseline for everything. So yeah, and you're very correct that a financing probably has to come in the first part of next year. The other side to it is the way that the agreement is set up, that, you know, I believe they could just get further diluted, which isn't necessarily the answer. But what I'm saying is Newmont and Sumitomo are going to push this thing. They're the biggest portion of the project. If they want to spend the money, they will spend it. And Irving has the choice to raise the money or get diluted. So I would say, yes, I would guess that they will probably raise money in the first half of next year, but I'm not necessarily sure but I think they're in a good position considering the potential and, you know, what might be ahead for these results. Again, if they're really good, then it will be that much easier to raise the money.
Well, we'll keep following along with it, and hopefully Irving has some good news flow out, and hopefully hole number two comes out with a big win for the company, something we'll definitely keep following along with here at the KE Report. But Brian, we were having an interesting discussion off mic about junior companies having, you know, being on the treadmill of raising funds and trying to build value but deciding to deploy it in interesting ways. And two of the companies that have recent news out that we alluded to at the onset is that FPX Nickel is going to be using about $1 million to buy back some of their own shares. And then you also have Montage Gold deciding to take a 20% stake in Sanu Gold and spending about 5.5 million Canadian on that. It's an interesting proposition to see, you know, pre-revenue companies taking cherished capital and not putting it in the ground, but actually doing other things with it, buying back shares or taking a strategic stake. What do you make of that process, and how has that historically worked out for junior mining stocks?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. It's one that I view with a huge amount of skepticism, especially the junior taking an investment in another junior. I think I'm probably most skeptical of that. When capital, especially over the last couple of years, has been so hard to raise, when a junior makes the decision that the money is better spent or invested or speculated, however you'd like to look at it, into another junior instead of their own project and their own business, it really sends me for a loop. I don't recall it ever really working out. There may be some examples out there that people can remember, but in my experience, it hasn't worked out. So Montage's deal, you know, mind you, the Lundins have such a good track record, but I'm not sure who's driving that, whether that's driven by the Lundins and it's, oh, we should involve Montage in this, or if it's the other way around. But again, I view it with a lot of skepticism, especially when you get up into those like $5-6 million types of investments. That's a big deal. And we'll see how that plays out. On FPX's side of things, it's to a much lesser scale. They can, if they choose to, like you mentioned, spend up to $1 million in buying back shares. They've got a really strong treasury in 30 plus million. So I understand Martin's and the board of directors' rationale to say, okay, maybe this is a good time to buy back shares. End of the year, FPX has had a tough year in terms of performance on the back of that First Nations issue last August. And, you know, maybe this is much as about protecting that downside in the share price as it is to just put it out there to say that, hey, look, we do have the money if we want to do this and we can buy back these shares and it's a good investment. But it's still, I the overarching thought is it's still a junior company saying that the money is better spent, you know, buying back shares than it is going into the ground or doing a technical study or doing this or that. So again, I view these things with skepticism. To me, FPX, I've been a longtime investor, and I respect Martin and his board to the utmost. And so I'm not overly concerned with FPX, but the Montage deal for in Sanu definitely gives me pause because I can't recall it working out in the past where you've had these sorts of arrangements.
Look, FPX, I feel like this whole share buyback is really just about telling everybody, reminding everybody just how much money they have on the balance sheet. It's something that I chatted with Martin Turin recently about through an interview on our show. This Montage investment, though, let's dive into that a little bit more because, look, Montage, they're investing $5.5 million. They get almost a 20% ownership stake, and then they get to join Anglo Gold that also has about a 14% stake, I believe, and then the Lundin family, it has a 10% stake. We need to understand Montage has over a $700 million market cap, so this isn't a huge investment for the company. Do you just think that this is more relationship-based, though, joining with Anglo, joining with the Lundin family, and really not having to focus on that exploration side of things, just being able to ride along with this investment?
Yeah, it very well could be. And honestly, I don't necessarily view it negatively. It's just the whole topic of what it sort of says that is interesting to me. And it's as much a thought exercise for myself into how these things work, but you could very well be right. It could be relationship based. It could be that they know or someone knows the geology well enough that this microcap is worth putting the money into. And maybe in the long run, the $5.5 million doesn't matter. It probably doesn't. It's still an interesting thing for a company that doesn't have any revenue to investing in another, you know, penny dreadful that, you know, just so many times I've seen these things not work. And especially when you talk about West Africa, depending where you are, these guys are in Guinea. There's definite risk there, no matter who's managing or who's involved. But you're right. In the whole scheme of things, it's a small amount of money for a company that's got access to hundreds of millions. But for investors, I think the more important thing is to think about the concept. And when you see it happen around the sector, not necessarily with those sort of crown jewel companies or groups like the Lundins, the Montage Golds of the world, to take pause and to think about what that means with respect to their own investment and make sure it's the right thing that the company should be doing.
Well, and just digging in on the concept even further, I guess it also comes back to all the times these companies, and not just these two, just any junior company has to do a raise. The investors that are behind that company maybe have a voice in how that money is spent. But in general, people are putting money into companies because they want to see the projects, you know, developed and moved forward. They're not typically investing in Montage so that they can take a position in a company in Guinea, unless maybe they're going to try to take the company over at one point, or like you're saying, work on these partnerships. And even the share buyback idea, you know, if you've got 30 million, sure, you can spend the million to do it, but you had to raise all that 30 million at one point, and those people wanted to see it go on the ground. So in general, I think that when you're looking at junior companies, how much money out of a capital raise should go into the ground? How much of it should go to G&A? Do you have any things that you look for as red flags or green flags?
Yeah, I don't have exact percentages when it comes down to how much should go in the ground versus G&A. Obviously, I'd like to see the G&A as low as possible. But there's that obvious connection to people that have had success, especially in the junior resource sector, seemingly always get paid for that. And so for the most part, I accept that to a degree. So I don't have a hard, fast number in terms of percentage. I think you can sort of tell when you see how a company, you can go look at the balance sheet, the financials, and you can see how they're spending the money and how it's, and then you take a look at who it is that you're dealing with. And you can sort of get a sense about how that money is being spent and how out in the open it is. You know, I think there's a lot of companies that do much shadier things, and you see contracts with numbered companies and arm's length deals with companies that are owned by management or a board of the director. Like, there's certain things that sort of tip you off to how that money is being spent. And although let's say the G&A is within 10 to 20%, which may be the top end of G&A spend versus what goes in the ground, you have a lot of question marks because of who they are and where the money is going. So, you know, each of these situations is so different, and I don't necessarily think there's a rule of thumb, but you know, generally you want to see as much going into the ground as possible, especially when you're talking about micro cap companies under $50 million market caps have to be putting, I don't know, 90% at least of the money going into the ground. You can't, I've seen enough companies where you've got a $10 million market cap and the management's taking $1 million in salary, and you think, where's the priority in this company? Well, you know where it is, and who knows how else in the financials things are hidden. So it's probably well over that $1 million that they're actually taking in. And so they're much more interested in mining the financial market than they are in ever creating or discovering a mine. So it's going to be up to that investor to look at each situation probably a little bit differently. But just know that those big names in the sector are going to come with bigger price tags. And I think for the most part, they're worth it. But it's going to be up to that individual investor to sort of where that line is and how opaque or clear the situation is with these individual junior mining company. But it's certainly a great topic to cover because not enough people look at financials. They look at how many ounces are in the ground and sort of the superficial stuff, and don't necessarily look or judge management by how they have the financials set.
So true, Brian. I love looking at financials, and they're pretty easy to go through when you're looking at an exploration company because it really is just all expenses. So see how that's being allocated, and also look at those management information circulars where you can then see how much management is getting paid and how many shares and options they hold to see just how incentivized they are with shareholders. Brian, this brings up a bigger topic then in terms of portfolio management as we transition into a new year. Look, 2024, if you are in a whole lot of sectors, but we're talking metal sectors, in precious metals, in uranium stocks, there have been some very good opportunities. And quite frankly, your portfolio should be up a little bit as long as you didn't chase some of these when the sector was really moving. That being said, I know you have a much more concentrated portfolio. What do you do as we turn the corner into the new year? Do you trim some winners? Do you load up on those winners? How do you at all just analyze your portfolio for that new year transition?
That's a good question. Again, I don't think I necessarily have any percentages of my portfolio in any one certain type of company or jurisdiction or anything like that. I think the baseline for myself is I first understand where my strength is, and it's with companies with a resource or some sort of technical study that I can kind of dive into. On the exploration side, I again know myself. I know that I've lost, or I have definitely lost money on solo explorers in the past. And not only that, but the risk of dilution is so high, no matter if the guys are basically successful or not, it's just the degree of dilution that you're going to be, or you're going to accept. And if it's going, the stock's going up, obviously that's easier to do. But for me, I want to be in project generators. That's basically how my portfolio is set up, is the mix between project generation on the exploration side, developers sort of in the middle. And then I've got, you know, G Mining at the top end that is a producer now, but their development side is, again, I think somewhere where my knowledge can help me get a step up on the market. So it's basically split up amongst those and where I see the opportunity. On the exploration side or project generation, not all those companies are created equal. And I find companies, and, you know, I'm a shareholder and I've covered Kinorland in my portfolio for a long time. I've been buying Kinorland stock a lot, and it represents a huge percentage of my portfolio. And it's for good reason. I really believe in management. I believe in the business model they have. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, especially when you consider how much cash these guys have. It gives them so much leverage to execute on projects like South Uchi and get arguably the best deal Project Generator could want on an optioning a resource project. So on the developer side, like you said, it's taking profits, it's moving them into other companies that I see that are selling for less than they're worth, and not getting too caught up into the blue sky potential, you know, gold to 10,000 type of mentalities, is hitting my price targets, taking some money or closing positions and moving on to the next thing. But you know what, like I said, how I started this off, it all starts with that individual investor first. You have to understand where your strengths are, where you want to invest, what your risk tolerance is. And then you sort of start balancing money through there and buy projects or companies based on their underlying value, not necessarily because gold's going to $5,000 or silver's going to $100. I think this is where people can get sort of lost and stick to those best of best companies, or as best as you can analyze yourself.
And I think those ones have been the ones that have performed better this year as well. Even some of the smaller ones, where the smaller sector, smaller stocks have broadly lagged the larger miners, even the mid-tiers. And one other note, hey, I had an interview with Kinorland Minerals also this week. So everyone go back through the website or podcast, listen to some of our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week. Brian, it's great having you on the show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. We will be back with you next week. I hope you all enjoyed this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.